Jewish history hasn't always been easy. In fact, we have a terrible, bloody history of all kinds of anti-Semitism, decrees against us, and so forth. So it's not so surprising that you often find people in the Jewish community, particularly older people who lived through the horrors of the Holocaust, who came out of Soviet Russia, have a serious and deep distrust of their non-Jewish contemporaries. So the question is it well-founded? Is it supported by Judaism? Is there an attitude within Judaism that says, well, in fact, not only should you not trust the non-Jew, you may even need to take preventative action and preemptive action against the non-Jew. Now, this is something that was debated throughout the ages because there were certain statements that are made by the Talmudic sages that give the impression that perhaps we should be out there attacking those who we perceive to be our enemies, even the so-called good ones, before they come and harm us. The Sicha we'll look at today examines that in the context of Rashi's commentary on this week's parasha. It will completely revisit the concept, contextualize it, and give us a great lesson in terms of who is our real enemy. Sala Pasuk, the Pasuk that talks about just before the Jewish people were going to have the miracle of the splitting of the sea, the Pasuk says, Vaikach Sheshma Yisrechev Bochur V'goymer. So the Torah tells us that Paro assembled 600 chariots with the best cavalry of Egypt. So the Mechilta, which is one of the Midrashic commentaries, points out, where did they get these animals from? These were the Egyptians who had feared Hashem and listened carefully to Moshe's warnings during the plagues of pestilence and of hail, and they had taken their livestock inside, and that's how they were, these animals. And so therefore, Mikanoi Rabbi Shimon Oimer, Toiv Shebegoim Haroig, Toiv Shebenachoshim Ritzoitz Es Moichoi. So therefore the Mechilta says, based on this, that we learn that even the best non-Jew kill him, and even the best snake crush his brain. V'yodua kushal maimazeh. And it's a very obvious question that has to scream out at you on this statement. How could the Torah possibly suggest that we should proactively go out and kill good Gentiles? Isn't that against everything that we stand for and everything that is right in the world? So, there are various answers that were given in various debates that happened in the medieval period, and some of them we'll actually look at during the course of the Sicha. The Rebbe says that there were various very famous and perhaps less famous debates on this subject through the course of history. And we're going to try and understand how we should contextualize this phrase. In order to do so, we're going to look at Rashi. Af Rashi, b'pirush al ha'Torah, omed al pasuk zeh. So Rashi also comments on this particular pasuk. And hetek melakos av zateves v'chol rechev mitzroim. So he quotes the words, all of the cavalry of Egypt, to pirush kim b'mechilta, and he gives a similar explanation to what the Mechilta says. Where on earth did they get animals from? Didn't all the animals die either during the course of pestilence or during the plague of hail? So he explains, the Torah says clearly that all of the livestock of Egypt were killed. So surely these animals couldn't be Egyptian animals. Surely. And you certainly can't say that these were Jewish-owned animals, and that's how they survived the plagues, and now they were taken by the Egyptians, because the Torah is very clear about the fact that the Jews left with all of their livestock. So where did they come from? Michel mi hayu? Who did these animals belong to? Mehayorei devar Hashem, from those Egyptians who actually feared Hashem's warnings during the previous plagues, and so they had protected the animals as instructed by Moshe, and they were, so to speak, good in their belief system then, and now they've turned into rogues. Mikan, says Rashi, Mikan, from here. Now, whenever you use the expression Mikan, it usually implies, from here we learn a general rule in life. From here, Rashi says a little differently to the Mechilta, not that you should kill the best of every non-Jew, specifically Egyptians, you should kill even the good Egyptian, and in the same way, even the good snake, you smash and crush its brains. So, in a moving cloud, it also doesn't really seem to make sense at all. Because we know that Rashi's interpretation is suitable for adults just as well as it is suitable for children. But at the end of the day, Rashi, we know, writes specifically to speak the language of the five-year-old who's learning Chumash for the first time. In fact, Rashi is so much part of the adult learning of Torah that there's even a view in the Shulchan Aruch that says when you review the parasha every single week with Shnai Mikra Vechatargim, you should also do Rashi. Nevertheless, there's a principle that the Rebbe has taught us multiple times, and that is that Pirush Rashi al Chumash Matim or Muvan Gam leBen Chumash Nemikra, that Rashi's commentary on the parasha is intended for the five-year-old who's just being introduced to the Chumash for the first time. Rashi speaks his language. And Rashi's intention is that this way, this young child should now be able to understand the simple interpretation of the Pasuk without having to look anywhere else. So that means, meaning to say that Rashi's intention in his commentary is that the five-year-old should be able to look at Rashi's commentary and get all of the relevant information that he needs to know for the understanding of this particular pasuk or this particular section of Torah, and he doesn't have to look any further. And Rashi's system is that either he explains things here and now on the spot, or he relies on principles that he has previously explained, and you can extrapolate from that, you know, how you should understand this pasuk. Now, the question that we have raised, which is, what do you mean? We should go out killing good people just because they happen to be non-Jewish? That's a big question. That's an obvious question. Even a five-year-old should have that question, even when he just learns superficially. So, how could Rashi make such a radical statement in Rabbi Shimon's name, go out and kill the good Egyptian, without giving any context, any explanation? It's really strange and unusual. A child could be scarred for life, essentially, you know, have a perspective on the rest of the world for the rest of his life because of this Rashi. Especially, this question expands and it becomes more serious because of context. You have to remember that Rashi relies on the fact that the student is learning in the correct order. He's learning the chronology of Torah, so he's already come across certain principles, like Ben Chomesh Lomad Kvar Mikoidem. The five-year-old has already previously learned the child has already learned that when Avram and Sarah went down to Egypt, yes, in the beginning there was some confusion as to Sarah's position and relationship with Avram, but once that was all cleared up, Paroi treated them really well and actually protected them from any harm. So, looks like not all Egyptians are so bad, right? And that's what the child already has in his memory bank. Not only that, but Yeser al-Kain, Lomad ben Chomesh, plus, the same five-year-old has also learned that Bashar Shebo Yaakov Avonov Lisyashe b'Mitzrayim, when Yaakov and co came down to settle in Egypt, Paroi Atzmoi Meretzoinoi Hitzialoi Shivam b'Meitav Ha'aretz. Paroi, of his own volition, chose to settle them in the best part of the land. Now, that's a great host. And it was a highly successful move for them. They took control of the area and they did incredibly well. If that's the case, these are the previous experiences that this child has had with Egyptians. They're not all bad. So the child, surely, if he's a thinking child, should say, how can you tell me I should kill every Egyptian, even the good ones, when we have our own history built on good relations at certain pockets of history between us and Egyptians? So how do you have this broad-based statement to say, no, all Egyptians are bad, even the ones that appear to be good, and you should kill them? Now, he hasn't learned it yet, but he will. Coming up in Parashas Ki Tzeitzei, okay, it's a long way off, it's all the way in the fifth book of the Torah, but still, when the child reaches that point, the question is going to become even more glaring for him, because there the Torah gives us a mitzvah, an instruction, which says, Shabbat ne'emar tziva yimefush, loy sisa'iv mitzri goymer, anesh yeshne isra afir leta'iv mitzri, bevada shein lohorgoy. The Torah is very clear that you may not despise an Egyptian. That's a positive commandment. Now, if the Torah is telling me that I may not despise an Egyptian, then I certainly, surely, I'm not allowed to kill an Egyptian. Ve'oid, and not only that, If it is true, as Rashi suggests over here in Rabbi Shimon's name, that you're supposed to kill all Egyptians, even the good ones, how then does the Torah ever suggest, how could the Torah ever suggest the continuation of the story of them, Parshas Kiseitze, where it says, Dor Shlishi Yovalahem Bikal Hashem, that three generations after an Egyptian converts to Judaism, they may marry into the community? Well, how do they even get that far if there's an imperative to kill them? So there's a major contradiction running over here between what we know from other areas of Torah and this particular statement that Rashi quotes from Rabbi Shimon. Surely the fact that a person who is of Egyptian origin decides to convert to Judaism, that would be an indicator that he is a good Egyptian. But isn't that exactly the kind of Egyptian that Rabbi Shimon warned us about? The good ones. the horrible ones we know, obviously, to be wary of. Rabbi Shimon's whole point was that the good Egyptians, who appear to be so friendly and open to Judaism, those are the ones to kill. So, surely Rashi should address this glaring question, if not right here in our pasuk, because we haven't yet got to the ultimate detail of the question that the Torah allows Egyptian converts. Fine, so address it then in Parashas Kiseitze. How come Rashi says absolutely nothing? So we'll have a look at various answers that are suggested as to how we're supposed to reconcile this opinion, and then we'll see whether or not they fit with Rashi. So various commentaries give an answer that is based on a kind of minor tractate in the Gemara Masechta Soifrim, where it says the wording slightly differently. There it's, well, majorly differently, actually, when you think about it. There it says, Atov Shabakum B'Shas Milchoma Haroik. There it says, when does it say you kill even a good non-Jew? When you're at war with them. In other words, when you're dealing with a conflict situation and it's a hot war, you don't have the luxury of deciding, are these actually good people on the other side? They're behind enemy lines. You have to attack them and kill them. V'hainu, so if you take that approach, as various of the arguments try to justify the statement of Rabbi Shimon, the only time you have carte blanche to kill any non-Jewish person, including a good person, is if they are at war with you. But if there's no war happening, and certainly if it's during peaceful times, then you would never be allowed to kill another person, no matter what their background, no matter where they come from. So, al derech zeh, let's take that approach and see if we can plug it into Rashi. Because that approach says, well, it depends on the context. If it's in the context of war, then you're allowed to go and kill. Perhaps we can plug this into Rashi and say, what's the context Rashi is commenting on? Where the Egyptians chased us, we had left Egypt, we were on the banks of the Red Sea, and now they came, Dafka, to launch a war against us. So they're combatants. We don't have the luxury of deciding which combatants are there against their will, and they're really decent people at home. So then, Shari Onshoi Shel Hayore Estvar Hashem Al Maaseu Ir Bizman Shamitzim Rotfach Rebnei Yisrael Menas Lilochim Imam B'Yamsuf. Because actually, if you look at it in context, these Egyptians who Rashi has identified as previously having feared Hashem's word, now they're being punished because now they're at war with us. So perhaps that's Rashi's explanation. Right, that's what Rashi wants us to know. Listen, ordinarily you should never speak badly about your neighbors, even if they're Gentile, and you certainly are not allowed to harm them, but this is a war situation. That was a war situation. They had come with belligerent intentions, and they wanted to harm us, so we had to kill them all. Does that work with Rashi? It's a nice suggestion. Says the Rebbe, it doesn't work. It's not going to work with Rashi. Rashi goes according to the simple understanding of a pasuk. Kevin shelashon Rashi mikan hoye Rabbi Shimon Omer kosher shebemitzrayim haroig. If you look at the specific wording that was used, he says mikan. So that's first of all mikan. It sounds like an extrapolation. From here, we could learn for other scenarios as well. And Rabbi Shimon says kosher shebemitzrayim haroig, that the so-called suitable or decent Egyptian should be killed as well. Pirusha, that teaches us a few things. The first thing it teaches us is that there's a reference point from this scenario to other scenarios where we can apply the same principle and say, yes, you may kill Egyptians or perhaps other Gentiles, even if they're good people. And second of all, mikan mi vayikach goy merechav mitzrayim imayse halekicho, dekem shayores dvar Hashem mitzrayim nosen es behemosev lefaroi lochein huroi la'onash shehevi ala b'kodesh baruch b'shas kris yamsev haroik. Look at where it's happening. The pasuk over here is talking about vayikach. They took the animals. We're not yet at the point where they've actually gone to war. They're just collecting the animals to create the cavalry that's going to go to war. And already at this point, we're saying, oh, good Egyptians should be killed. That means to say, this implies that they're not deserving of death because they're actively chasing and looking to kill us, just simply because they have malevolent intentions in the supplying of hardware for the war. But they're not actually fighting the war at this point. So that means that oid koydem hashas milchama lifnei parim v'amitzim ischilu lilochem befoilim b'nei Yisrael, that the pasuk that Rashi is commenting on is prior to the actual conflict. So we can't say, as comfortable as it would be, that Rashi believes you can kill even the good guys in a time of war, because the scenario mikan, from where he learns the principle, is not a scenario of war. It's a scenario of preparation for war. Okay, so let's try and see if we could still hang on to this interpretation. Look, maybe we're splitting hairs over here. Maybe realistically, the fact that they're now gathering the cavalry that will go to war with the Jewish people, surely that's already a war. Surely that's already a declaration of war. If you see your enemies amassing their tanks, do you say, well, it's not yet a war, we don't have to react? Still, even with that argument, we still cannot satisfy ourselves to believe that Rashi's interpretation is that only in the actual battleground are you allowed to be indiscriminate in your killing. And there's a very clear reason why this cannot be Rashi's view. We've already pointed out, and this is one of the most important things you have to know about Rashi, that Rashi kosa pirusha gam avor ben chomesh. Rashi speaks to a wide audience that also includes a five-year-old who is learning this information for the first time. Because a primary part of Rashi's audience is the young child, therefore Rashi always looks to speak as clearly as possible. If Rashi really believed that the only time you're allowed to kill willy-nilly any kind of Egyptian is dafka during a war, he would have said so. Rashi is certainly not going to believe that it's the child's responsibility to go do a whole lot of homework until eventually he digs up the alternate version of the sentence in Masechta Sofrim, which may never happen actually. Rashi should have said it. Especially because if we're going to go with this argument, then it is a fundamental clause of when are you allowed to kill right across the board, dafka during war. What if it's a critical piece of information, Rashi would have said it. And once we have that in mind, the principle which says, if Rashi had something to say, he would say it clearly. For the same reason, we're going to look at various other suggestions that are given as to how to explain away Rabbi Shimon's view and see that none of them fits with Rashi. L'dugma, here's one example. Aleph. Shapirish klal ze shamer b'shimin hu loy shakoshes shemitzrim ra'oi le'onesh haroig. It's not saying that really every Egyptian, even the good one, deserves to die. Ella, what it means is afila koshes shemitzrim kozeh ha'oimer haroig. The word haroig is actually a quotation from the good Egyptian. In other words, don't read it as good Egyptian haroig, you kill him. Rather, read it as good Egyptian's mantra is haroig, he wants to kill us. Don't be fooled by the nice external appearance. I know. Azagam koshesh b'mitzrayim muchon l'dunay l'maves harayg asmach umdin b'elvad loy chakira hygenus v'li lafeich bischusoy. In other words, according to various of the commentaries, what Rabbi Shimon is trying to say is they have a totally different outlook on law and order to what we have. Because in their society, the good Egyptians believe in the death penalty, and even if they don't necessarily have indisputable evidence, so they'll accept DNA evidence, or they'll accept camera evidence, which of course would never stand up in our courts. They say, Haroig, we want blood. The death penalty is a good thing. Whereas the Jewish community says, you've got to find a million ways to excuse somebody from the death penalty and be absolutely sure that you have a watertight case before you ever, God forbid, send somebody for execution. As we know, our court system requires such incredible, thorough investigation of the witnesses. Those witnesses had to have firstly warned the individual, and then we still try and find reasons to excuse him. Okay, so that's one of the explanations, that haroig is not a statement of how we should look at that Egyptian, but rather it's an acknowledgement that we should appreciate that's how the Egyptian looks at a criminal in his society. He's very quick to pull the trigger. One explanation. Here's another explanation, another way that they try to justify Rabbi Shimon's statement. Sometimes there are statements of our sages that are deliberately exaggerated for impact. And this is one of them. It doesn't literally mean kill every good Egyptian. It's just highlighting the fact that, unfortunately, there's a lot of bad blood between them and us. And so we really don't trust them. And if you put it into context, you'll see that there are other statements Rabbi Shimon makes that appear to be equally exaggerated and non-literal. Go back to the Masechta Sofrim, you'll see various other statements that Rabbi Shimon makes that also seem to be pretty radical. For example, Hakshera Shebenoshim Balas Kshofim. He says, a good woman is also a sorceress. Yeah, go say that one aloud at home. How dare could Rabbi Shimon ever have really intended that a good Jewish girl, a daughter of our matriarchs, a ksheira, is actually a machshefa, is actually a witch? Definitely must be an exaggerated concept. All Rabbi Shimon wanted to do was to say, you have to realize that the concept of sorcery is something you've got to be so careful to the nth degree. Even a good woman has to be careful not to get sucked into it. So he's exaggerating the point to make the point. And would say the same thing about derech ze yesh leforish bin kosher shebe mitzrayim haroig she'ein hakavone kipshut ele b'derech guz ma'amnas ladgish b'toikef ad kamein lismach aleim. So Rabbi Shimon's not saying a call to arms, let's go out and murder Egyptians in their sleep, even the good ones. What he's saying is you have to understand this history over here. The Egyptians are not nice people. They've treated us terribly over the course of history, not only at that period, but even later as well. And so therefore, don't trust them. Really, really don't trust them. And if you want to know how much I believe don't trust them, I'll use a radical statement which shouldn't be taken literally. That's a second possible explanation, which also will not fit with Rashi. He has a third one. This one perhaps resonates a little bit more closely with Rashi's reality. We know that Rabbi Shimon lived through an incredibly dark period of Jewish history, one of the roughest periods of the Roman Empire, and the Jews suffered terribly, as Rabbi Shimon himself did, at their hands. So ve'elehem niskaven Rabbi Shimon b'maimor kosher shebimitzrayim haroi kim shalolu heru sina glui libnei Yisrael. B'dugmas hanocha shamuzgum yad lachrei ze hamole be'eres. Rabbi Shimon was just referring to his personal experience. He saw the venom of the Romans. And when he spoke about crushing the brain of the snake, and when he spoke about destroying the good Gentile, he was talking about the people he lived with, who were so violently anti-Semitic. That's actually who he had in mind, and you couldn't blame him. It's much like the person who comes out of the Holocaust and cannot trust a German, and you understand it. And if you take that approach, as some of the commentaries try to point out, then actually he's not talking about the Gentile nation in general. And in fact, he's not even talking about Egyptians at all. In fact, we have a variety of places in the Torah that indicate we should show some compassion, and certainly that Hashem showed compassion to the Egyptians. And so that's actually quite a logical position, because at the end of the day, if you have a bad experience, as Rashi himself did, right? Rashi lived through the Crusades, terrible period of Jewish history, for at least in Western Europe. So you can understand that you're going to say, those people, don't trust them. They are bad people even when they appear to be your friends. So any of these kinds of explanations sound beautiful, but they just don't work with Rashi. They might be valid arguments, but they don't work with Rashi's presentation. Maybe Rashi kosher should be mitzayim haroig. Harei hoyal Rashi loisif midas hezbrig de levoyas kavonis maimer ze. As we already said before, if Rashi meant to say something other than just simply go and kill the good Egyptian, then he would have clarified. He would have said, I don't really mean Egyptians, I mean the Crusaders. He would have said, I mean that they talk in a particular way where they're violently predisposed, or whatever other explanations there might be. Which brings us then to a really big question. Now we've got the whole of, we've got this big burning question over here. What kind of an attitude is a Jewish person meant to take to their non-Jewish colleague at work or neighbor? And now on top of that, we've got a really burning question, which is, let's say that we will come up with a satisfactory explanation of what Rashi really meant to say, and it does not sound all that bloodthirsty after all. Let's say that we will offer an explanation that is so clear, as the Rebbe often does, give such a clear expression, it's like, oh, why didn't we think of that? Something that will show that it's so obvious to everybody, including the five-year-old, why this is an appropriate and a meaningful and an acceptable statement. Let's say that's true. That will only raise a massive question in the opposite direction. Then why were there all of those mega debates, some of which cost people dearly, trying to defend this position? Why didn't none of them just quote what must be the very obvious explanation of what Rashi has to say? These were serious times and heavy allegations that were brought against the Jewish community, often from the Christian world. If there's an easy go-to explanation, hey, look at Rashi, he explains it and that settles everything. It's so obvious, even a five-year-old will know it. It would have been quoted, guaranteed, in at least one of those debates or in at least one of these commentaries. The pshita she'ena kavona kan l'taretz she'elos shel ben chomesh be'ezber lefi asagosei asher eina atam v'abiro amiti she'oise yimtzu b'sfarim anar rak l'chigdal. Clearly, it goes without saying that whatever answer Rashi posed to the five-year-old has to hold water even when he's an adult. It's not that he's fobbing him off and saying, when you're older, you'll understand, or let me just give you a throwaway answer right now, but then later you're going to come across all these other books and then they'll give you a deeper answer. God forbid, should we suggest that Rashi would ever propose an explanation, albeit to a five-year-old, that is not absolutely 100% consistently true at all times and all places. It goes without saying, and it's shocking to even consider otherwise, that whatever Rashi puts into his commentary is truth, absolute truth. Which leaves us with an incredible paradox. Rashi clearly was giving a message in this commentary that is self-explanatory. You could just, if anything, look at the words of the Mechilta maybe to iron it out, but it's absolutely clear and self-explanatory on the one hand. So the context of Rashi's commentary is clear like a bell. And yet, on the other hand, it's of absolutely no value to any of the arguments that any of the great sages had through the course of history, because actually, perhaps they're talking about two different things, as we'll see. However, before we can get to that answer, we have a string of questions and diyukim, smaller questions about what Rashi has said and nuances in the language of Rashi, which all need to be addressed as well. And we also have to understand that number one, Pirush Rashi ain't a sef shal piske halochas. Rashi's job is not to tell us halocha. And a bir pshat haksuvim. Rashi's job is to explain the simple understanding of what the Torah has said. Ve'im kein madu nochutz l'tzorich pirush haksuvim lehavi es divrei amechilta mikana v'yibshim oimer. If Rashi's intention is to explain the pshat, they took animals and attached them to chariots and went chasing the Jews, how is it relevant to the pshat to know that Rabbi Shimon says, from here we learn that you should even kill the good Egyptian? All Rashi needed to do was to address the question, where did these animals magically appear from? So he could have addressed that and said, remember the good guys who previously were afraid of what might happen to the animals if they left them out in the fields? Those same guys who put the animals away now supplied animals to Pharaoh's army. And we don't have to know if they did so willingly or not. It's actually not even important for the pshat. And he could have stopped there. Why does Rashi go one step further and start telling us a halacha? You need to know this, that Rabbi Shimon says, from here we learn, don't trust them, and actually go out and kill them. Question number two. Let's actually say that for whatever reason, that piece of information, don't trust even the good goy, is something that you have to know in order to understand the context of this pasuk, where the good Egyptian was the one who landed up supplying the cavalry. Okay, so if you're battling with the concept, how does it happen that there was a guy who just a couple of weeks ago seemed to be so good and on the same page as us and aware of Hashem's warnings and taking them seriously, how does he turn and become such a traitor and now supply weapons to Paro's army? Okay, fine. We understand. Okay, you got to contextualize it. So the good guys are not so good after all. Why do I have to then be told to kill him? Well, how's that relevant to the pshat of this pasuk? Question three. The very last point that Rashi brings, which is to crush the skull of the so-called good snake. Where do snakes come into the story? I mean, we understand that it's a mashal to illustrate the point, but it really has nothing to do with a simple understanding of the psukim. And final question. Madua yashtzorich limud mikan shetoyvah shebenechoshim retzoyitz esmoichoy v'arimikra molad yibarakosev ha'iva oshis beinecho v'hu yishuv choroish. Why does Rashi have to say mikan? From this story with the Egyptian army, we learn that you should go out and crush a snake's head. What do you mean? We don't learn it from here. We learn it from the story of the original snake, where the curse was that there will be this constant enmity between snakes and humans. He'll try and attack you and you'll literally, what? Crash his head. So, number of questions about Rashi that we need to address. However, before we do that, there's four other nuances to the language of Rashi, which we also have to draw attention to. Oi diyukim bepirush Rashi. There are other nuances. Number one, l'shema hevi Rashi kan hashem balamemer Rabbi Shimon. Why does Rashi have to tell us who taught this principle that you kill the good Egyptian? Why do I need to know that is Rabbi Shimon? Vary commission is bor kame peomim Rashi maskir uzois rakashi esh poset toises bir lepirushoi. We have already established in the past that Rashi will only quote the name of a person who taught a particular thing if knowing who said it will help us understand the principle better. Number two. Why the distinction? When you're talking about the Egyptian, you say kill him, and when you talk about the snake, you say crush his brain. Why is that? Why is that a relevant detail? Why that nuance? Also, third point. The correct phrase, based on other psukim, a pasuk about the snake back in Bereishis, the original snake, and a pasuk in Tilim about the Leviathan, is that you crushed the head. Why does Rashi change it from the language of the Torah and say you crushed the brain? Why is that significant, to crush the brain? And the last nuance, Ma'u adiuk mikan, oy Reb Shimon oy mechule shebonem ma'et she'in ilmud zois mimochim acher, ledafke mikan. Why does Rashi seem to highlight and emphasize that it's specifically from here that Rabbi Shimon learns his principle, as if to imply, you might have thought he learned it from somewhere else, but he didn't. So k'dei levorin yin zeh, shlaktim shay leklolis ha-misereis al-pirish Rashi zeh, as is often the case, to answer a long list of questions, you actually have to address a kind of core question. Let's go back to the version that we had in Masechta Sofer, which we offered as the first possible explanation, where it said, "Hatoiv shebakum b'shas milchama haroig," the one that says that you should kill a good Gentile when it is wartime, surely that is olemes gamas pshutu shel mikra. Surely that dovetails really nicely with the pshat. Me'ach hasham mitzrim bo lilochem im bnei Yisrael. Considering that the Egyptians launched a war against the Jewish people after they had set us free. Even the language of the Pasuk indicates that Hashem's response to the Egyptians to wipe them out was a warlike response. Hashem ish milchama, as we say in Oz Yashir. Right? Hashem will fight for you, the guarantee that Hashem tells Moshe to tell the Yidden. So hare gam ben chomish meibin shebeisim melchome im oyev yefshel afrid es aksherim ashe betzad shekeneged b'shas ha-melchome atzmo. You don't have to be a genius, you can even be a young child and appreciate that in the throes of war, you just don't have the capacity or the time to start sorting out which combatants are really malicious and which ones are just there because of conscription. You've got a war on your hands, you fight. V'im kein hare adderabe. Now that raises a very interesting question. If there are two possible versions of what Rabbi Shimon said, and one of those versions really works well with the storyline because it's the story of a wartime situation in which everybody was killed, why didn't Rashi rather use that one? That surely works much closer to the pshat than the generic statement, all good Egyptians should be killed. V'hainu, which indicates, Aleph, b'chol ois, b'chol matzav, she'ezeu, heifach ha-tzedek v'ayosha legamrei. When you say all good Egyptians should be killed, that implies regardless of the circumstances, so the guy could be sitting drinking coffee and you have the right to kill him, which seems so immoral. And second of all, Adom ha-madgish, sha'yores, dvar Hashem, ischai, misirach, m'pnei, osnes be'moys, elefari, kanal, sif, gimel. That also seems to imply that there's a contradiction over here, because you're saying kill everybody, whereas this one, this particular explanation will say, well, kill the guys who got involved in the war. So why does the good Egyptian die? Because he supplied the war effort. Yet, as much as a question as that may have appeared, it's actually not such a big question. Because, let's be honest, if you read the pshat of the pasuk, the whole miracle of the splitting of the sea and the drowning of the Egyptians was not a response to their war approach. How do we know that? Well, go back and read the story. It was actually something that was planned. Hashem told Moshe clearly, I'm going to harden Paro's heart and he's going to chase you. Right? That's what's going to happen. It says clearly in the Torah that Hashem hardened Paro's heart, forced his hand that he would chase the Jewish people. So he's not liable now for launching a war because he was pushed. So if a person does something because Hashem left them no option, it's not really fair to punish them for that. Rather, you have to say that the experience of drowning the Egyptians at the Red Sea is a continuum of the plagues, which is all punishment, retribution for the fact that the Egyptians enslaved the Jewish people in such horrific circumstances for such a long time. The culmination of all of those plagues, which were all about retribution against the Egyptians for having enslaved the Jewish people, was when all of them would be wiped out at the sea. That explains why Rashi, who always looks for the pshat of the pasuk, can never bring as an explanation that you kill an Egyptian during a time of war, because war implies that they're willing combatants. Because the pshat does not seem that way at all. The pshat seems that they were led into a trap in order to be killed, and not that they willingly launched a war against the Jews. This is our first clue as to why it is that Rashi doesn't stop at the point where he says, oh, you know why the good guys also suffered? Because they offered, well, they solved the question for us, where did the animals come from? And therefore they were punished. But he adds also Rabbi Shimon's mikan, from here we learn a principle. In other words, mitivrei Rashi, shayoras dvashem nosubei moisein lefarei movin, shagam eim hoyu bekriyas yamsuf. Once Rashi tells us that even the good, God-fearing Egyptians supplied animals to Paroi for his army, we pretty much can work out now that they were also present at the time of the splitting of the sea. Which means, obviously, they were also drowned at the sea together with everybody else. So now we've got an intriguing issue over here. Why would a guy who, yes, of course, he supplied animals to Paro's army, and we get that that's a bad thing, but he is also a person who fears Hashem. Why should he be punished in the one fell swoop together with the rogues of the rogues, the worst Egyptians who were so malicious and so belligerent? If we went with the Masechta Sofrim's approach, that they joined the war, and if you join the war, we don't have to now sift through your record to decide if you deserve to survive the war or not, then it all would have made sense. But now that we have proven that the fact that they were chasing the Jews didn't earn them the punishment, because they were forced to chase the Jews, Hashem hardened their hearts. Now it's difficult for us to accept that the people who were so-called decent, who had fear of heaven, why should they actually die and be punished alongside the rogues of Egypt? Plus, the child already knows from the story of Sodom and Amorah that Hashem's system is, if you can find good people in a city, not only will they survive, they could protect the whole city. So what's going on over here? Here you're seeing the exact opposite. Not only were the decent Egyptians who feared God unable to save their fellow Egyptians, the exact opposite happened. They got sucked into the vortex of punishment that was meted out on the bad guys. Why is that right? Why did that happen? Therefore, Rashi says, you see what we learn from here? From here we learn, from Hashem's treatment of these so-called good Egyptians, we learn that even the good Egyptians deserve to die, and even the good snake deserves to be crushed. Levoy, that means to teach us. That the decent Egyptian wasn't punished for supplying his horses to Paro's cavalry. Rashi wants us to understand, the moment this guy hands over his animals, you now know he is a rabid anti-Semite. The fact that he protected himself from the plagues was because he believed that Hashem's going to harm him. Yes, he had that Yiras Hashem, but that didn't stop him from hating Jews. And the moment he had an opportunity to harm Jews, it came out into the open. So it's not like we thought, because he supplied animals, he deserved to be punished. It's because he supplied animals, we now understand why he deserved to be punished. His bile came to the surface. His poison spilled over. And it's dafka poison. Oisos sina arsis bedugmas anocha shevias kol amitzim lanas is bnei suri bishon b'choska kol kach. It's the venom like a snake that was sitting, cooking inside of this Egyptian while his fellow Egyptians were enslaving the Jews, and he perhaps wasn't doing so. The venom was still there, and now it has come out to the surface. That's Rashi's message here. The good Egyptian was not good. He was pragmatic. He realized he didn't want to lose his animals, and he took Moshe seriously. But he was a disgusting human being who hated Jews with every fiber of his being. Now we can understand why Rashi uses the expression mikan. Ah, now at this point we understand why the good Egyptian is killed. Can you see how we're shifting? We're not saying from here you learn that anytime you encounter an Egyptian, even if he's a good guy, go out and kill him. Rashi's got a completely different approach. He says from here we understand why the good Egyptian was killed. Up until this point, up until the story of Kriyas Yamsuf and the supplying of horses to go and get those Jews and who knows what to do with them, up until this point, we didn't know that the God-fearing Egyptian was actually anti-Semitic. It's Mikan from this story that we get the truth on the good Egyptian. The fact that in all the other plagues, except for the two where he behaved differently, but in all the other plagues, we see nothing that distinguishes the God-fearing Egyptian from everybody else. We still don't know, you know, are they on the same page or are they not on the same page when it comes to anti-Semitism? So, because none of the other plagues involved everybody dying, so we don't know that everybody who's infected by the plague is necessarily deserving of the worst punishment. In other words, we don't know that they really are wicked people. The truth is, even according to the Pshat, the Jewish people also had inconvenience from certain of the plagues, at least the first couple of plagues. So we could argue, look, the fact that the guy who fears God also has locusts eating his crops means that he's got a little bit of anti-Semitism, and so he deserves a little bit of punishment. And even when it comes to the final plague, the plague of death of the firstborns, which of course is very serious stuff, Rashi already discusses how come it is that the sons of the maidservants of Egypt also died during that plague. So he says, because they enjoyed seeing the Jews enslaved and they actually participated. Kloima, that means to say, Shagam Oinesh Misaze, Kemishloi Bala Mishpoho Kulo Kimalchelekot Mimela Labichoiris, and it Afkala Midam Lea Sholishus Amitrim, Lachen Gamre Ashvoch Nichlu Bemakozoi. The fact that here you had a punishment which did not necessarily kill off the entire family in one shot. Yes, it did kill the firstborn, which is very significant. So that indicates that this is not the full blast of punishment coming to the Egyptians. And so even somebody who perhaps was not as wicked as the Egyptians, because he himself is a slave, he's just gloating over the fact that the Jews are slaves, he could also be punished in that particular punishment. Whereas Dafka Mikan, specifically at this point, Dafka at this point where we reach a state that every single Egyptian will be wiped out, now we know this is the ultimate punishment because everybody's getting killed. So therefore, this must tackle the ultimate wickedness of the Egyptians, their hatred of the Jews to the core of their being. If the so-called God-fearing Egyptian is killed in this same punishment, that is evidence to the fact that Hashem sees in that person as much vitriol as to the next guy. So Mikan, from here, Rashi says, we get a picture on the entire Egyptian community of that time. Now we understand the principle that's being taught over here, which is that even the good Egyptian deserves to die. Because Rashi raises this principle about killing the good Egyptian, specifically when he wants to address an issue in this pasuk, And in movement bepashtus, shekoshet shebemitzrim koyel amitzrim me'adeirahu shalei medubar bepasuk sheoisa mitzrim afila kosher shebehem ruuyim la'oinesh haroig umitam hanal. That tells us clearly that when Rashi says the good Egyptian, he means the good Egyptian of this period of time, because he's commenting on this pasuk, and therefore he's teaching us about the Egyptians who are the subject of this pasuk. Whereas Egyptians at any other time in history, Rashi's not discussing them, which is why Rashi's commentary could never help for any of the debates that they had through the course of history, trying to defend the apparent attitude of we should kill non-Jewish people, because he was never talking about non-Jewish people, he was talking about the Egyptians of that time. We said earlier that Mikan means you learn from here to reference somewhere else. Where's the somewhere else? That would seem to imply later generations. Mikan, from this story, we have a rule that applies to other generations. So how's it going to be relevant to future generations to know that there was a time where there was a particular group of Egyptians amongst whom even the good guys deserved to die? Therefore, Rashi brings the rest of what Rabbi Shimon had to say, that the good snake, you crush his brain. Why? Rashi wants us to understand this has nothing to do with Egyptians. It has to do with snakes. And when snakes rear their heads, you have to crush them. In other words, what Rashi is telling us is, of course, if a snake is in the vicinity, you may have to kill the snake, but there might be people who emerge during the course of history who have such venom against the Jews that they are the snakes of that period of history. Just like we find in the positive sense that there's an individual called a nachash, a snake, Shimshon, who behaved like a snake behaves in a positive way to bring down the plishnim. That's what Rashi wants us to know, that if there should be at any point in history people or an individual who rise and behave like a snake, they have a venomous hatred of the Jewish people, then they deserve the same fate as those original Egyptians. You'll notice if you had the Dafka at this point, when the Rebbe is speaking about the possibility of real live people today, he doesn't complete the sentence. He doesn't say the words to crash. He just says, etc. Unfortunately, Rashi knew this firsthand. As we already mentioned earlier, he lived through the Crusades. You look at the writings of Rashi and his students and his descendants, that some of which are included in the Kinois of Eicha. So they knew what a snake was, and they understood that snakes have to be put down, and you don't give them a second chance. And with that, we can understand why Rashi specifies over here that you crush his brain rather than just saying, like the Lashon HaPasuk, why does Rashi change it from head to brain, even though the Pasuk, which speaks about crushing the snake, speaks about crushing the head? Why? Because that same Pasuk says there's an immediate threat. Right now, it's you or him. Either he's going to strike your heel, or you're going to strike his head. Which means, when there's a war going on, then you can kill the other guy. That's what Rabbi Shimon comes to teach us. No, there's more to that. Now that we understand that Rabbi Shimon is saying it's not about the fact that there's a war happening, it's the fact that they have this venom inside of themselves, this poisonous hatred towards the Jewish people. Keno gamlin and anoch all of God's HaKadosh Baruch Hu ve'eva oshis ben chovein goymer she'ein lechakois ad she'anoch she'itkoif es adam azay yeshuv choroish and miyad be'isri es anoch she'tzoit es moichoi kem she'gam tov she'menachoshim u'bedoim elekoshe she'memitzrim miparsha seinim ve'isidore seinim mesukon ve'eva oshis goymer. What's it teaching us? Don't wait until you are in a perilous situation to react. You see that snake. You know that it's venomous. You don't have a way out. You kill it. You don't wait for it to strike you first. Much like the treatment of these people in Mitzrayim. Now we have a beautiful concept in Gemara, which says sometimes you quote something, you bring it in order to teach us about our story. And we actually land up learning something about the quote. Why did Rashi quote the story of the snake? To try and clarify our story, right? But it actually turns out, that he's actually clarifying for us when it says that you kill the good Egyptian, what does it actually mean? It's actually clarifying for us. You know why the good Egyptians were killed? Because they were like snakes. There's no open season over here to go out and say all non-Jews are bad. If they're venomous, if you see that horrible vitriol, that's a different story. In that generation, those were those people. And that's why they deserved to be killed. So what was unique about that generation? That they had so much venom and so much hatred to the Jewish people that it was right across the board, every single member of the community. Something which is quite unusual. That's why Rashi specifically uses the expression crush the brain. And that brain, that word brain, is going to give us tremendous insight into what was wrong with the Egyptians and, of course, how that could impact future generations too. Kashem sheitzel anachash, asibit gzeres veva oshis goyim oisiv anachash hoya orum goyimer moichoi. You remember the story of the snake. It's not the story of venom. It's not the story of somebody who wanted to kill Adam and Chava. It's the story of a sly, crafty creature. V'anachash hoya orum. He had a mind. A mind that schemed ways to cause trouble. It's a direct result of his mind and his scheming that there was the sin of the Eitzadas. The exact same thing happened with the Mitzrayim. They also had a unique kind of hatred for the Jewish people. Why? Because if you remember from the beginning of the story of the exile in Mitzrayim, Paro told his people, be clever, be sly, scheme against these Jews, lest they overwhelm us. It was the moyach, it was the investment of brain, it was coming up with a strategy of how to deal with and tackle the Jews. That's what caused such a terrible exile for us. That's why Rashi speaks about crushing the snake's brain, not its head. The reason a snake deserves to be destroyed is because of the slyness of the snake, historically. Which is what created this enmity between us and between the snake. And that's exactly what happened over here in Mitzrayim as well. Why did the Egyptians deserve all of them to be killed? Because they all got into the scheming and strategizing about how they could harm the Jewish people. The only thing is that this now raises a general question about the whole explanation Rashi has given. How do we actually know that the punishment against the Egyptians was retribution for the terrible hatred of the Jews? How do we know that it wasn't just a decree that Hashem decided, which is beyond any rational explanation? Hashem decided he's killing the Egyptians and nothing you can do. It's to answer that question that Rashi has to tell us who he's quoting, Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon dorish timely dikrav as a gamkin leshitosei, because Rabbi Shimon never says there's such a thing as a gezerah. Rabbi Shimon's approach to learning is that there's always a reason behind the pasuk, and it's my responsibility to never satisfy myself and say, well, it's gezerah sakosif, that's what the Torah said, and we just have to accept it at face value. He dafka always argues that what you need to do is you need to find the reason why that is what the pasuk says. Now we appreciate and understand why throughout all of the generations where Jewish people were backed up against a wall to try and defend the statement of Rabbi Shimon, they never quoted this explanation of Rashi as a means of defending themselves. Because Habir Amor Omnam Poshet Behechlet, there's a very obvious reason. There's a very obvious reason why Rabbi Shimon said what he said in this context, which is what Rashi's doing. Rashi is talking pshat. Pshat is the commentary on this pasuk. This pasuk is about the Egyptians back then. So the Egyptians back then, there's a reason why the good ones had to die. It doesn't help you when you're sitting in the Middle Ages trying to defend people who say you think that that all Christians should be killed. It's not going to work, because Rashi is talking about Egyptians 3,300 years ago. Number 2. Rashi, as we've already seen, brings the principle that you crush the good snake's head as a continuum of his argument that you kill the good Egyptian. In fact, he actually extrapolates that the principle of killing the so-called good snake is learned from here. That indicates that this story is a unique story. It's a story, so to speak, like the snake. And perhaps you can extrapolate about other snakes from here, but it's not going to help an argument in the Middle Ages when there's some baron or nobleman who's got a sword to your neck and says, tell me, is it true that Jews really believe that they should kill every non-Jewish person? It's not going to help, because Rashi was only talking about the Egyptians. But when you look at Rabbi Shimon quoted in any other source, like the Masechta Sofrim, then Rabbi Shimon doesn't seem to be talking about the Egyptians of that generation. He's making a general statement, like it says, Toni Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Hatov Shebaakum Chula Haroig, Hatov Shebenachoshim Betzoitzitz Moicha, Hakshere Shebenachoshim Balas Kshofim. He seems to be saying generalized statements. Good non-Jews should be killed. Good snakes should be killed. The best woman is a sorceress. So now Yevshel Avorikain came and changed Medubar Kan Bedur Masuyim or Besug Masuyim Shagoyim Amitzrim. Then none of the explanations we've given for Rashi will help, because Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is not talking about a specific time period or a specific group of people. Va'oid Fulamon. The fact that those sources include the third category, right? There's the Egyptians, or the one version that it's just Goyim in general, the snake, and then it adds the story of the women. Now, the women have absolutely nothing to do with the story of the Exodus from Egypt. So then, you have to say that each three of the stanzas is independent. So, if we're talking about the nature of women, we're talking about the nature of women, not women at a particular time in history, the nature of women. If we're talking about the nature of snakes, we're talking about the nature of snakes, not snakes in a particular environment. If that's the case, you have no choice but to believe that Rabbi Shimon is saying that this is the nature of non-Jewish people, to have this aggression within them, and they deserve to be killed. Now you've got to defend that position and explain it. So you'll go back to the various defenses. No, actually what we mean is that's how they speak about their criminals. Or actually what we mean is that it's during a time of war, or etc. Now that we've explained Rashi's opinion, we're going to learn that Rashi actually gives us an insight into something halachic. And then, of course, there's a take-home lesson for us. There are various places, although Rashi's primary goal is to teach us the Pshat, there are various places where Rashi gives us an incredible insight into the legal issues within Judaism. We're going to see that here too. Das Rabbi Eliezer of Masechta Sanhedrin, in the first chapter of Sanhedrin, there's a Mishnah where Rabbi Eliezer says, "Shezeiv v'chulav anochash kol akedim lahorgon zocha," that when it comes to certain animals, like a snake, if a person sees them and you kill them, you've got a merit. It's different to the opinion of Ein Tzarich Bezin Shilchov Gimel Kedasa Tanakama, and he argues that you do not need any kind of court system in order to choose to kill a wolf or a snake, as the case may be. And that's in argument with the earlier opinion in the Mishnah that says, no, you have to take the snake in front of a Beis Din and you have to assess it and rule on it. So Rabbi Eliezer says, you see a snake, you kill it. In the Gemara, v'nechelku bozer Rabbi Yochanan b'Rav Shlokish. Rabbi Yochanan b'Rav Shlokish argue over it. Shlokish svir leisha dvorim amurim rakash anochish heimes adam shoz mischai mise v'al zeh ein tzarech besnin k'ma shetzarech b'shor v'chulei. Reish Lakish says, we're talking about a case of here where we know that this snake has killed a person. Unlike other animals that might have killed a person where they'd have to go before the Beis Din and the Beis Din would decide to execute them, in the case of a snake, first person to come across it kills it. Whereas according to Reish Lakish, if this snake has not yet killed anybody, if you see it and you know it to be venomous, that doesn't excuse you killing it. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan understands that Rabbi Eliezer's opinion is you cannot rehabilitate or domesticate a snake. So it has no value to society. It will only be trouble, and you sit, you've got to kill it, even if it's never killed before, because it will never be tame. So now that we see that Rashi learns the principle that you smash the head of a, or the brain of a snake, and we derive that from the story of the Egyptians, that even the good Egyptians deserve to be killed, and as we know, Rashi first and foremost addresses the pshat, the simple understanding of whatever it is that he's saying, that teaches us the following things. Number one, it teaches us, because Rashi collates the story of killing a snake and relates it to the story of killing the Egyptians, we know that we don't have a court system where each individual Egyptian stood trial and then was killed at Kriyas Yamsov. It was across the board. Likewise with a snake, it doesn't have to go to court. Clearly, if there was any kind of court system, even if it happened in the Beis Din Shomaila, people would have been judged on their individual merits, and we would have the responsibility to try and find a way to exonerate them, and we don't find that at all. We find that everybody was killed. All at once, one shot, everybody in one shot. From there we learn that Rashi obviously is of the view, you don't take the snake to the courts. Number two, we also see that Rashi's view is you don't have to wait for the snake to have killed before you kill it. Because we see that Rashi says you even kill the good snake, that means the snake that hasn't killed. And we learn it from the story of the Mitzrim, the Egyptians who feared God. And they didn't actually do anything to harm a Jew, they just hated Jews. So they haven't actually harmed anybody and you kill them already. Number three, the third halachic principle we learn from Rashi is that a snake is in its own unique category, because right from the beginning of time, there is this animosity between us and snakes, and therefore, unlike any other animal that perhaps could be domesticated, there's no hope for a snake, and therefore you can kill it. So Rashi's taught us three halachic principles. You don't need a court to kill a snake. You kill a snake even if it hasn't yet killed, and this is unique to a snake. And then there's a take-home message for us. We know very well that the snake is a primary metaphor for our own Yetzahara. Sometimes the Yetzahara comes dressed up as a good guy. I also fear God. You know, if there's a warning, I'll also put my animals away. I'm a good Yetzirah. וטוען שברצון לעשות שלום עם היצר טוב, אלא שיש לעשות פשרה. הוא יניח ליהודי ללמוד תורה וכו' בזמן תורה וכו', והיצר טוב יניח לו לגרור מעט אחת הבוס בזמן האכילה וכו'. So this kind of yetzer hara is the yetzer hara comes along with the scheming of a snake, the sly approach of a snake, and says, listen, I don't want to fight. It's too much trouble and too much energy to constantly fight. Let's make peace. I'll tell you what. When you're learning and davening, I won't disturb you. When I'm eating and enjoying life, don't disturb me. So Rabbi Shimon warns us, don't be fooled by a nice, friendly, diplomatic yetzer hara. Crush his brain. You dare not make any form of peace with a yetzer hara, because the yetzer hara is a venomous snake that only wants you dead. Regardless of what guise he comes in, he hates you absolutely. Why is the Yetzer Hara being accommodating and saying, I'll allow you time to learn and to daven? It's all just part of his strategy. It's all part of his scheme. Like the Gemara says, today he tells you to do this, and tomorrow he'll tell you to do that. Very famous insight of the Friedrich Rebbe, that it means today he tells you to do something which is Alpi Torah, because that way you're now listening to his opinion. You've got to crush his thinking. Crush his scheming. That's why it says you break his brain, not his head. One other point. We know that in Tilim it says that you should work with the labor of your hands, and it specifies your hands. That the engagement that a person has in earning a living should only involve their hands, the action part of a human being. But your head has to be absolutely obsessed with Torah at all times, even when you're at work. That's what it means to crush his brain. That it's our responsibility to break the Yetzer Hara brain. Our minds should be occupied with Torah and mitzvahs. That should occupy. That's what we think about. That's what we care about. That's what we strategize about. Everything else is just practical. I've got to run a business. I run a business. And if we follow the advice of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and we break the brain of our Yetzer Hara during the course of Golus, we'll see the fulfillment of the promise that even our enemies will make true peace with us. And the Gemara tells us that it is the Nochash, this is the enemy that's going to make peace with us. That the snake will be converted to become something positive and at peace with us. How do we achieve that? By ensuring that our brain is focused correctly, thinking as the Torah would want us to think, and absolutely shutting out without negotiation any sly suggestions of the Yetzer Hara, no matter how lucrative they may sound.